Blog Talk Radio.
Peter Paul Brazola with the new shadow on a Friday afternoon in the middle of September. Got a little bug in my throat, but the show must go on. If you want to call in, the guest call-in number is 1-347-633-9620. Well, Acorn, that rotten nut, is in the news again. This time, they're really peeling away layer after layer, exposing the rotten core of this organization. Did you know that Acorn, one of their associates, founders, Saul Alinsky, was connected to Al Capone and the Chicago Mafia and Frank Nitti? That's where they learned a lot of their tactics, and the Mafia there was an organizational study done many years ago, and the best organizations, organized organizations, the way they were set up, were the Roman Catholic Church, Standard Oil, and the Mafia. They've gotten, Al Capone was smart, and the successors of the mob, and this, some of this is shown in Coppola's film, The Godfather, how they branched out when they got tired of stuffing bodies in trunks or on meat hooks. They got into legitimate businesses, restaurants, cheese, finance, extortion, the bookies, loan sharking, and now we really believe that they're involved and have been for a long time in real estate racketeering. And remember at the end of The Godfather, the third sequel, where, what's his name, the youngest son of the Godfather, of Marlon Brando, decided to get out of all the crooked business after they lost the casinos in Cuba when Batista was ousted and Fidel Castro came in 1959, I think it was. I was in school at the time. But I remember we thought Castro was a liberator and all that, but it turns out he was even worse than Batista, and he's still in power, although he's transferred some of that to Raul. But the mob loved Havana, because Cuba, because they could operate down there with their gambling casinos, their prostitution, and all of that, and it would be, and of course there were the kickbacks to the government, and there wasn't any the same type of problems that they encountered here in the States, or up in the States from down there, from their perspective. So, and then of course the mob's greatest and probably best investment was Las Vegas, and it was a mark of genius for when the mob moved west, and that's also in The Godfather. There's a lot of accuracy in that film, even though it's, quote, fictional, and they don't use the word mafia, but the financial geniuses in those organizations, those families, when they decided to stop killing one another and others and use that muscle between their ears, they came up with some fantastic ideas that led to the development of places like Las Vegas and Nevada. Of course, it's crooked as all hell, but you got to give the devil his due. You know, they put something together, and of course, Bugsy Siegel, I think that's the guy, and there was a lot of violence and abuse of women, but, you know, we've got to recognize that fact, and of course, a lot of the politicians in Nevada are supposedly connected or allegedly connected to underworld interests, let's put it that way. But what people need to realize is that Acorn is not this great charitable community organization. It never has been, and it's unlikely that it ever will be. They use the poor, they use ethnic minorities like blacks and Latinos, and they also con and co-opted the Archbishop Bernard Chiel back in the or Al Saul Alinsky did back in the late 30s, early 40s, when he was one of his, he was the deputy, in effect, of the Chicago Archdiocese, the number two man, and he was a well-meaning man. I met him once before he died, excuse me, and he was concerned about the plight of the working men and women and the poor and the underhoused and that segment in our society. But he got co-opted, and the Catholic Church's social services got co-opted by Saul Alinsky, who had other motives in mind that weren't charitable. And Saul Alinsky, his ancestry, ethnic ancestry, since they're into this these days, well, about Obama, Saul Alinsky's parents were Russian Jews. I don't know if they practice. He went to the University of Chicago. I think he may have studied law, but he didn't finish. He's not the only one. In fact, one of the great journalists, the guy who exposed Abu Ghraib and did some things in Vietnam, he also went to University of Chicago and may have I think he studied law there. A lot of people have gone to law school and also have worked in lawyer's office, clerked, like I did. And, you know, they don't have a bar card, but they know as much, if not more, than people who have bar cards and who try to use those bar membership cards to bamboozle and rip off clients and not be accountable. You know, if lawyers were held to the same standard that doctors, malpracticing doctors were held to, we wouldn't have as many lawyers in the business. A lot of them would be out of business or behind bars or facing a whole mass of lawsuits. But maybe that'll change because people are getting tired, especially with people are finally paying attention that one of the high costs of medical insurance is because doctors have to practice preventive medicine and do all these tests so that they don't make a mistake and end up in instead of in the operating room or their medical suite, end up in the docket in a courtroom. Who wants, and of course their medical practice and malpractice insurance rates go up every time they get hit. Now, an interesting, it's a film with Paul Newman and Sally Ann Field about a doctor who was tired and he was in obstetrics and working in a Catholic hospital. And Paul Newman was this drunken lawyer and he took this case. And the church tried to settle it. And these are actually, these cases do happen with Catholic hospitals. There was some controversy down in New Orleans, or New Orleans as they say, when Bishop Cody, John Cody, was the bishop down there. He later was transferred to Chicago, and he got a red hat, a card. A lot of people would have given him something else on his head. But there were problems with the Catholic hospitals and lawsuits. And what's unfortunately, they don't try to do justice to the victims and try to cover up things. And it just makes people very angry. People who are good Catholics get so angry at the church, they leave the church. And you can't blame them, you know, especially when Catholic hospitals involved in a malpractice suit that they really did malpractice, and they should, you know, have insurance to cover and deal with it and dispose of the case and move on and improve their practice and delivery of medicine. But these things do happen, and happen in other hospitals as well. Some of the more notorious cases, and it's kind of interesting because one of the many conventions that are that I have covered was urology. There was one here in San Francisco, and they had the most interesting exhibits and what they call poster sessions dealing with circumcision, penis size, and all kinds of things which are of interest to doctors. And they got into AIDS, and do condoms really protect people from contracting AIDS or any other sexual transmittable disease? But there have been cases where babies and young males have been circumcised and lose part of their penis, and they're big settlements. in these cases. It's really sad because, you know, and then we have these crazy gays and homosexuals who want foreskin restoro. I don't think, I think the insurance companies consider that an elective. So much for that. But getting back to our 501c3s, which get federal funding, like community development block grants from HUD, AIDS, education, a growing number of these organizations, you cannot get their financial records. They claim to be transparent, or that's what they say, but that's for the other guy or the other organization. That's not for them. They're working, doing God's work on earth and all that. And if you bring it up, you're racist or you don't understand or you're against the community. They use all these verbal tactics to divert your attention from the issue at hand, which is a question about their competence and accountability. Have you noticed that there have been two books out, one by T.R. Reid, who sounds like a very left-wing journalist, about The Healing of America. I think that's the book. I've heard a couple of interviews, and he claims that he has gone around the world and looked at the medical delivery of medical practice and health insurance and hospitalization around the world. And there's some questions about, especially when he was in France. He claimed that he didn't pay anything and he had his shoulder examined and all that. But what's interesting is Jack Cashel, who is a distinguished author, whose latest book, What's the Matter with California, what he should have written was, What's the Matter with Our Medical Delivery Systems and Insurance, and the practices by malpractice lawyers or tort lawyers. He had a similar experience, had to use the French medical system. He speaks French, a very erudite man. He's written several books, one on Obama, on Ayers, or I think he, no, not a book, but several articles on Bill Ayers, who's back in the news. That's the alleged terrorist who allegedly was involved in the murder of a San Francisco cop. It may have been more. When he was here with Bernadette Dorn. They seem to like Northern California. That's a fact. They come here to vacation up in Northern California where all the pot is, our pot farms. But anyway, Cashel's experience, his daughter bruised her arm and he brought her to the French doctor, and the doctor malpracticed. And it made the situation much worse, and what was a minor bruise or scratch became something, a major medical problem. Fortunately, it was taken care of, and the child didn't lose her arm or her hand. But it would be interesting for those two to debate. I'm trying to persuade Cashel to do that. You should follow his thing. There is a lot of relevant, documented information out there. I would recommend that you go to World Net News Daily and check out Jack Cashel's regular columns. You should also check out Drew Raines, A Marine's Disquisition. He's on this network every day. I was asked to do that, and I declined because it's a lot of work, and he does a lot of volunteer work for senior citizens and veterans who can't afford lawyers, and he's in effect, studied a lot of law himself, served as an embassy guard I think Bangkok, Soviet Union, and he had 10 years of honorable U.S. Marine service, and he's the great nephew of General Smedley Butler, the guy who saved the country from fascism, from overthrowing the Franklin Roosevelt administration. That's an interesting story. Even the History Channel ran a series, program on that, which was quite a surprise, considering the History Channel is owned by the Hearst Corporation. And then there is Art Burnclaw, whose organizations, Veterans for Constitutional Law, they do a lot of volunteer work for veterans, trying to help them, because anybody who's been in the military has learned the hard way, if they didn't know this beforehand, that they cannot sue for injuries incurred while in service or in the military or in the reserves. That's connected to military service, and it's called the Ferrers Act, and he and his organization and other veterans are trying to get this overturned. They're also trying to get veterans the due rights the due process and the rights that they deserve for back pay, medical care, competent medical care. And this is one of the issues of the Obama health care proposed plan, that what's going to happen to the veterans if this thing goes through. Very few people are talking about that. But you should go to that website, Veterans for Constitutional Law. If you can donate some money, that would be appreciated, because they don't charge like some of the other veterans organizations charge membership fees. Veterans for Constitutional Law does not do that. And they won't. And you know, Art's an interesting character, because he goes to Vietnam. He served in Vietnam, the Korean War, and goes to Vietnam to help those people over there, I think, you know, kind of rebuild their country, whatever. Vietnam is fast recovering. They're even trying to grow vineyards. Of course, they had the French influence, and there's coffee. So we're seeing these imports come here. Now, what's interesting in the worldwide, let's put it, the depression or the mini depression, I understand that many of the merchant ships, especially in the Far East, are sitting idle with just minimal crews. Their holds are empty. They're not traveling and transporting goods and engaging in international trade because of this worldwide mini depression. So people should be aware of that, that it hasn't only affected Americans over here, but it's affected people abroad as well. I don't know if we've got a caller here or what. Let me see. No. But, something happened here. So, you know, you should pay attention to those things and, you know, realize that other people are suffering too, and you still got... You know, you're still living in the United States. It could be much worse. It could be like the 30s. So, excuse me. Again, you know, don't get violent. Don't get hostile. Use your head. Use that muscle between your ears. And look at all of these issues. There's not only this healthcare issue. There's this whole business about this growing dependence on these 501c3 so-called nonprofit or non-taxpaying organizations. They are becoming or have become the new political machine. These people go out the media has finally discovered that, hey, Acorn has been going out and registering voters. Many of them, or a growing number of them, that are the voter registration certificates that are examined are bogus. And they're not the only ones that have done that. They have done that here in California during when Gore was running against Bush. They had a thing in California called the Macarena Express, where these various organizations, we believe that SEIU and other leftist radical organizations, were doing pre-election registration and then demanding to vote down in the Southern California, and then they were bused up to Northern California. They registered to vote and then demanded to be allowed to vote and voted and then disappeared. And we have seen some of this. Californians Against Voter Fraud witnessed these people being coached. I happened to walk on, come out of the voter registration office here in San Francisco, and I heard this guy, this sounded like an organizer, and I stopped and listened, and he was telling these people, and they look kind of bizarre to me. They look like people who lived in San Francisco or who, you know, had homes and jobs. And he was telling them to go in, register to vote, here are some addresses, and these later showed up. We published them in Veritas USA. I will put them back up again, how they did it. And then he told them, once you register to vote, ask to vote absentee, which they did. And what happens was they were told who to vote for, and when they did, when they finished, they disappeared. We couldn't find these people. By the time the voter registration's office and the office in Sacramento, which sends out all this political mailings and what have you, propaganda, depending on your view, to the address that these bogus voters had registered at, the people got this mail and said, this person has never lived here. Why am I getting this mail? And then when they checked the residents, the owners of these houses, checked further, they found that these people didn't even exist. So we've got some of those certificates and the letters from homeowners who, there were at least one, Nick Rommel, who happened to be a city official, had three of these voters, bogus voters, registered at his house. Of course, they were voted absentee and were registered, you know, roughly the same day. And he got the certificate cards, which everybody gets in the mail, and he said, I don't recognize any of these people, and he wrote a letter to the registrar of voters in San Francisco. So we published that. We'll republish it again. Go to our video multimedia site, YouTube, Amicus Veritas, A-M-I-C-U-S, V-E-R-I-T-A-S, and we'll be putting up more things, especially things like voting fraud, which have come from our sister organization, Californians Against Voter Fraud. And we'll be putting up more things on military personnel who are being railroaded by local civilian authorities. There's the case of Dustin Taylor in Virginia. There were the four sailors, what they call the Norfolk Four. Questions about their trial, and it was about 12 years these guys were in prison. And, of course, you know, when an American serviceman goes and is tried and sentenced to state prison or a foreign prison, all of that training and the expense of the American taxpayer is paid. That is lost. You can't get that money back. He doesn't pay that back. I don't know if any women have been tried. I've been checking the court-martial and state dockets and records, and I haven't seen any women there, but, you know, statistically, there ought to be some out there. There have been cases where the wives of servicemen have been tried by military courts. There's a couple of cases there, and they have been found guilty for trying to kill their husband or killing her husband. I'll look those cases up again. And, of course, there is the campaign to free Stephen Nery. You should contact Governor Schwarzenegger's office and ask him, why is this young man, he started as a boy, a post-pubescent boy of 18, raped, drugged, and railroaded by San Francisco authorities, the corrupt politicians here, judges. And all his rights were violated. He was railroaded into San Quentin prison, and then they transferred him to Pleasant Valley, and then he's in another prison. Jack Cashel has written about this in What's the Matter with California. You can go on the web. It's we spent about 10 hours documenting, a couple of years documenting with documents and pictures and everything up on Free the Sailor, Stephen Nery, N-A-R-Y, and he's not related to the other Nerys that you might pick up on the web. But again, you know, and also you can email me at pverzola, P-V-E-R-Z-O-L-A, at gmail.com. We have several emails, and I'll set those up as separate because I'm trying to keep my personal things separate from the media things that we do and the citizen investigations. But again, you know, and you have the right. If you, you know, when every year, HUD and these various organizations, Department of Education and all that, give millions of dollars to locales. I know they're not going to be doing as much this time around because the money's not there, but they have in the past to local organizations, and we have over a million 501c3s around the country. Several of them, I think it was Congressman Daryl Issel, Issa from Southern California has done his own investigation of ACORN and the affiliated organizations. We had several up here, and, you know, it isn't only ACORN. You've got to peel back the skin, and you'll find there's much more there. It's like peeling back the skin on a tumor or a cyst, and, you know, you see more and more rotten corruption and poison. But these organizations operated under nice names, especially Community This, Citizens This, and a lot of them are radical left-wing fronts where the leadership gets big salaries, bonuses, they drive cars, some of them have cocaine and those type of habits, and we know some here in San Francisco and in Northern California. Some of them are into pedophilia, laundering money, offshore bank accounts. What it has broken down to, or what it can be distilled down to, is these organizations increasingly look like they're racketeering enterprises. In fact, Raul Elmison, a retired lawyer 50 years of experience, was preparing a RICO suit against some of the these housing organizations that violate tenants, especially senior citizens and people who are disabled, and there have been rape of children in some of these organizations. In one case, a hitman was brought in from the Philippines, and we'll put those documents up on the web. But this is how these people operate, and there's no oversight. You can't get a federal government to come in and investigate. They seem to have a very extensive political connections, like to Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Boxer, this Lynn Woolsey, Dianne Feinstein-Blum, you know, all kinds of political clout and muscle, and they're not afraid to use it, but, you know, even muscles get flexed too often, and there's a reaction, and I think that people are finally standing up and saying, enough. And what we should do with these politicians who will not hold these organizations accountable, like Nancy Pelosi, who must be the most hated woman in America, there's a growing number of people are thinking and thinking out loud that she should, if she's not going to retire, resign, should retire by, you know, next year when so a new candidate can come forward and somebody who will truly represent the interest of all the people and won't be stirring up trouble by calling people, you know, AstroTurf for brains and all the things that she said. You know, now she can dish it out, but she can't take it. And it looks like it's beginning to get to her. Her sentences are disjointed. There's something wrong with that woman, and has been for a long time. And I think she should do the country a service because of the position she's in. She should do the Speaker of the House. She should do the country a service. And if she's not going to retire now, or not going to resign now, she should retire. So that somebody else can run from San Francisco. We'll probably get a new speaker, and I don't think it'll be from California, that person. We need a change, and we need reform. That's another thing. You know, that phrase was bandied about. You see it on bumper stickers, on cars and all that, change. But what is change? What are we doing, just changing the faces and not reforming the system? And that's a question that thinking people are asking. You know, a change is just fashionable. You know, it's like changing a shirt or changing your pants or a hat. But a reform is like taking an enema to the body politic, and that's what we need, an enema to the body politic. It is so constipated, and this corruption keeps festering, and it's time to, you know, to purge the body politic, clean it out. And that's not change. That's running a Roto-Rooter through it. And you know, when people should start to think in those terms, that this bandying about of this word change really is meaningless, because we have, if you look at the people, we have the same people. They've just changed the political administration from Republican to Democrat. So it's really meaningless, and it's also a diversionary tactic. The other thing, those of you who remember Walter Winchell, who was one of the worst, and I consider an evil media person back in the late 40s and 50s, he was the person, those of you who remember Tokyo Rose or Rose Diakino, she was one of 20 young Japanese girls. She was an American born in Los Angeles. Her family, as it was the custom, sent her to Japan to, you know, learn the customs, and she got stuck there at the beginning of World War II, along with other young Japanese girls who spoke good English. And they told them, if you don't broadcast, you're going to go to the concentration camp. And the Japanese concentration camps were just as brutal as the Germans, and they used the women for comfort women. She was one of 20, and she was compelled to do this. She didn't do it voluntarily like Axis Sally, who was an American who broadcasts for Goebbels. And then there was, I forgot his name, an Englishman, Lord Haha, that's it, who also broadcast for the Nazis. He was hanged, he was executed by the British, tried and executed for treason after World War II. Axis Allie American. She was sent to an insane asylum, along with Pound, Ezra Pound, who supported Mussolini. He ended up in, I think, St. Elizabeth's, which is a mental institution in Washington. But Rose DiAquino, people testified that she was forced to do the broadcast, and she wasn't the only one. There were 20 of these girls, these young women, and she was the Justice Department was going to drop the charges, and then things got heated up, stoked up over here by Walter Winchell, who, interestingly, also Russian Jewish background. Parents were from Russia, and he was a raspy, really a moron in a lot of respects. Anyway, he was the one that stirred up resentment against her and the Justice Department, and there were people in the, and this was Harry Truman's administration, that did not want to prosecute her. Now, the as I understand the jurisdiction, when an American commits an act against treason, whatever, against the country, and he's abroad, that person, when apprehended or extradited, has to be brought to the nearest federal district for prosecution and trial. And that would have been Honolulu. But at that time and still today, there were a lot of Asians living in Honolulu and in Hawaii. And so the Justice Department decided to rig the case by bringing her to San Francisco, where there was a lot of hostility against Japanese because of Pearl Harbor. And she was tried here at the district court. And in fact, I knew he's dead now, Wayne Collins Sr. He did the original trial. She was convicted and sentenced, I think, to 10 years in women's prison in West Virginia. And then after she was pardoned, I worked supported the pardon, and I did independent research on her case. And I knew Wayne Collins Jr., who finished the case because his father had died. She went to Chicago and set up the Toguri. That was the family name, her Japanese family name, Toguri Imports. And she lived there until her death, which was recent. And this is another case of Walter Winchell and these moronic media people, they're not even journalists, railroading people into prison. Now another thing that he did, during the 50s, a series came out on black and white TV called The Untouchables. And here he had beefed up or fictionalized the role of Elliot Ness in breaking the Chicago mob and Al Capone. The facts are that Elliot Ness had very little to do with breaking the Al Capone mob and stranglehold on Chicago. The people involved were the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, Colonel Robert McCormick, who asked President Hoover to send in a special squad from the IRS accountants and investigators, and one of them was a little guy named Ira Erie. And he got a hold of Al Capone's books, and that's how they convicted Al Capone and got him on, he didn't pay taxes on all his illegal liquor that he brought in from Canada. They didn't get him on the St. Valentine's Massacre, even though his psychic fingerprints were all over the bullets. excuse me. So that's how Al Capone was brought down by the federal government. He ended up on Alcatraz out here, and they let him out early, I think, and he died of syphilis of the brain. He was, cheated on his wife. There's a very good movie, the one in 1959 with Rod Steiger, who played Al Capone, although the role of Elliot Ness has been largely fictionalized, and we can thank... We can curse Walter Winchell for that. He's long dead and what we call late and unlamented. But this is a political fact, and it's also a political fiction. But, this is how these things get started, and unless they're challenged. Now, one of the other political fictions, it looks like it, is that Obama is the first African of ancestry to be elected U.S. president. According to Warren Harding's biographers, Warren Harding was accused of having what they called Negro blood at that time, or African blood, and he replied, "I can't help it if one of my ancestors jumped over the back fence." Warren Harding for all of the problems that he had. He had a very corrupt administration, the Veterans Bureau, as it was called at the time, and his attorney general went to jail, went to federal prison, a lot of people. But he was the first U.S. president, also the first U.S. president to visit Canada, the first U.S. president to go into the Deep South and tell white audiences that they had to give the Negro his civil rights. No other president had done that. Before, his predecessor was Thomas Woodrow Wilson. He dropped the Thomas, and he was a racist. He resegregated Washington, D.C. That's not talked about. And he had all, you know, I guess he was an uptight Presbyterian. But, you know, we should look at that aspect of his presidency, that, in effect, he was a racist. And remember that the blacks who were drafted and went overseas in the American Expeditionary Force, there were segregated units. Even right up through World War II, they had black segregated units. In one famous unit, they called it the Red Ball Express, were these truck drivers, black truck drivers, who kept the supplies coming for Patton's army, gasoline, and that's one of the ways that one of the methods that he used to win the to relieve Bastogne in the Battle of the Bulge. The others were the Tuskegee Airmen, the black pilots, who trained at Tuskegee Institute. And they didn't want them in flying planes, and it was Eleanor Roosevelt. She did a lot of other things, but this is one of the good things she did. She said, look, I trust these guys so much that I'll fly with them, and she went up with one of the pilots. And there's another movie about a ship, a frigate, a U.S. frigate, with an all-black crew. It was an experiment, and they had one white racist officer, and the captain was not a racist, and this ship was escorting convoys to England, and they never lost a convoy, but they didn't get a unit citation. But there's a movie out, and I'll try to find it and bring it up on either the YouTube site and on the blog talk. But, you know, these are a lot of the historical facts that have been ignored or people are ignorant of. But they are facts, and there's a lot of fiction out there, and this is one of the things that this program tries to deal with and tries to strip away the veneer and get right down to the nitty-gritty, get right down to the grain of things. The other thing that we're upcoming, we've got the upcoming, we're going to have one of my favorite lawyers that I did some programs with, the late Melvin Belli, or Bellicose, as his critics called him. He loved animals. He was about 300 pounds, and he liked Italian greyhounds, which are the smallest of the greyhound family. And he also had a pet iguana, and when I interviewed him, he was lamenting the death of his pet iguana. It's quite amusing, this interview. And also we talked about animal rights and another case where down in L.A., this man the L.A. Sheriff's Department were trying to arrest this guy, and he brutally kicked the sheriff's dog, and the dog bit him in the cojones. So and when the trial came, he had to drop his drawers, and it was an all-woman jury, so he got what he deserved. You know, you don't go around kicking dogs. In fact, I had a case where a veteran, his neighbor's dogs had bitten him in the groin. Fortunately, it wasn't a lot of damage, and he didn't have to drop his drawers. But he did recover on that one. But these things do happen. So the moral of that is you are responsible for the acts of your beast, whether it's a dog bite or a cat scratch. And actually, a cat scratch is more dangerous because you can because of the habits of cats dealing with mice and that. They come into more dangerous, more potent bacteria, which can kill people or seriously injure people, let's put it that way. Whereas a dog bite, it's sharp and then it numbs, it can swell, depending where it bites you, of course. And, of course, we have this famous case here in San Francisco where a rare fighting breed, Canaro Pissarros, I think that's what they're called, bit and killed this lesbian in the apartment building, and the dog should have never been allowed to be kept in that apartment building, and he mangled and mauled this woman horribly. And they were owned by two lawyers. This goes to show you, lawyers can be incredibly stupid, arrogant, and irresponsible, and they're not the only ones. And a famous case, which is part of it's on appeal, the lawyer was disbarred. He was tried here in San Francisco by the same lawyer who, same prosecutor, Terrence Allen Ann, and the case was transferred to L.A. because of all the pretrial controversy and all that. But the woman's still in state prison. The man is out, and he's lost his bar license, bar card. And people really aren't feeling sorry for him. But, again, you should be very careful about your dog. Another thing I've noticed, people who have attractive dogs, if they're walking them on the street, strangers will just instinctively try to pet the dog. And there have been cases, and even children, and there have been cases where the dog has snapped at, the person's trying to be friendly and nice, but the dog doesn't appreciate this type of attention. So, in effect, the word is keep your hands to yourself and let the dog sniff you and watch your children, because if the dog bites the child, of course, the person's going to sue. But, this would be unnecessary if you'd taken the precaution of telling the child, do not touch, and don't get too close. So, but nevertheless, there's people who have animals as strict liability. But, again, this is adding to when these cases occur, it adds to the high cost of insurance for everybody because it's all figured in. And we're seeing more and more of these dog bite cases. People are keeping these dangerous dogs, and they are injuring and killing people. And there's no need for this if people were to act sensibly. And, of course, would you believe it or wouldn't you believe it? People are still texting and using their cell phones. And we just caught a guy from CBS. We got CBS on his license plate. He looked like a media person. And we got part of him. We caught him texting while speeding. So we'll put that up. But it just goes to show you that these people don't give a damn about the law not to use the cell phone while driving, not to text. But they're doing it anyway, and Richard Badisco, retired cop, and other people think the way to discourage these people is to have, very heavy fines, such as $1,000. And second offense, $5,000. If they don't pay, they lose their license. Tow the car. But, all these accidents that are occurring, and there's an increasing number of them, because people, you're not paying attention to the road, to the drivers around you. Also, we are seeing bicyclists. We'll show some of the pictures of what they're doing. They seem to think they have special rights and privileges and exemptions. They go through red lights. They're even texting. They're on the cell phone. And they're not paying attention to their cycling. And people who drive cars have to watch out, not only for other drivers who are reckless or not competent, but they have to watch out for reckless bicycle riders. So, again, we've got a lot of responsibility as human beings. We live in a great country, and there's a lot of benefits, but there are also responsibilities. And so people pay attention, and if you see somebody's doing something like this, tell them in a nice way, hey, get off the damn phone. That's not nice. Well, there are other things you can say, and people have said them. And, of course, the reply from some of the people using a cell phone is you can't put it on the air. But anyway, I want to thank you all who have listened. We use this day because we lost Thursday. But we'll be back on Tuesday at 5 p.m. We'll see how this time works out. We still have made up our mind. And we will have more interviews with other people and some of the stuff I've done in the past for other radio stations and when I was a correspondent. Again, this is Peter Paul Verzola. I think I've got a little of my voice back, or what's left of it. And working with the new shadow. And we want to thank you for listening. And again, support organizations like Veterans for Constitutional Law. Go to their website, Drew Raines' Marines Disquisition, and go to our YouTube site at YouTube, Amicus Veritas, and Amicus Veritas blog. Thanks for listening.